Humanity in Healthcare is seeing and being seen, and hearing and being heard, and healing and being healed.
More human healthcare means I know what matters to my patients, not just what's the matter with them.
And more human healthcare means extending kindness, compassion and fair treatment, regardless of my faith, nationality and race. Remembering that underneath it all, we're all human.
More human healthcare means remembering everyone involved is human.
As staff, it would mean the umbrella of safety and compassion is extended to me. As a patient, it would mean not to be unfavorably cared for because of who I am.
More human healthcare means a warm and listening face, an attitude of respect, and an honest and open response.
Humanized healthcare for me is more than just dressing my wounds. It's holding my hand, looking into my eyes, asking how I feel, it's checking that I'm not scared, treating me like a human being.
Welcome to the Humanising Health podcast series from the Point of Care Foundation. I'm Birgit Simons and I'm the Chief Executive of the Point of Care Foundation. Today's episode asks the question, why is medicine so medical? And explores ideas around humanising care in the context of death and dying. I've got two guests today who are going to help talk about these issues. And I'd like to welcome Richard Smith and Libby Salno. Richard is the chair of the Point of Care Foundation and was formerly the editor of the BMJ. Libby is a palliative care medicine consultant with Central North West London NHS Trust and is an honorary lecturer at St Christopher's Hospice and University College London. She's also an honorary consultant at the WHO Collaborating Centre in Community Participation in Palliative Care in Kerala, India. So you're both very welcome today. Libby and Richard were both members of the Lancet Commission on the Value of Death and have written and spoken a great deal about the way we as a society deal with death and dying. As you know, the Point of Care Foundation's mission is all about humanising healthcare. And I suppose I wanted to just start off to open up the conversation to ask, what does that term humanising healthcare mean to you, particularly in the context of death and dying? Richard, what would you say? What does this term mean to you, do you think?
Well, I suppose the first thing I would say is that death and dying is one of the great human experiences, both for the person dying and for the people around them. And in the Middle Ages, people would spend a lot of time thinking about how they were going to die and preparing for death. Death is a social event. It's a community event, a family event. But what's happened in recent years, and it really is comparatively recent years, it's become a medical event. And I think back to when I was a student, a medical student, a long time ago in Edinburgh, and I heard Ivan Illich, who was a great critic of industrial medicine, speak. And he said, death, suffering, pain, these are part of being human. And people and cultures have always had to have ways of dealing with these things, rituals and meanings. And obviously religion was a very important part of that. And then along comes modern medicine with a sort of false promise. We can sort all this out, you know, give us enough time, we can solve suffering, we can relieve pain, we can fix death. And Illich would say that's a false promise. And in some ways it's left people very exposed because the family and cultural mechanisms have dwindled away and people are left just with medicine. And of course this reaches its sort of supreme point in the current pandemic, when we have people dying alone in intensive care without their family there, able perhaps to communicate with their family only by iPhones or iPads. I mean, that is the sort of supreme clinical death. But I would say, unfortunately, lots of people die badly in this country, although ironically, we're ranked as having some of the best palliative care in the world. The commission that Libby and I are working on, we started with the premise that we have an unhealthy relationship with death. And what interests me is to find that very few health professionals, doctors, nurses, others dissent from that. And what's happening a lot of the time is people are, and their families are just not aware that people are dying, that doctors tend to avoid that, what's often called the difficult conversation that says, actually, you know, you're coming to the end of your life and you need to think about where we go from here. It's a lot easier to just go on treating people with more chemotherapy, more antibiotics, more this or that. And I think that can lead to some very inhumane experiences of death. And so I think humanizing death is very much about, you know, how you relate to those people and recognizing that it's not just a medical event, it's a much broader event.
Mm. So, Richard, you've written a lot about the dangers of over-medicalisation of care. You know, I suppose the sort of, to play devil's advocate, I'd say, well, isn't that what modern medicine's all about? Isn't that what people want, to know that every avenue of medical treatment has been offered when they need it most? Why is this such a problem?
Just to talk a little bit more broadly about medicalisation, I mean, if you sit in a GP surgery, a lot of the people that you see are there because their lives are in a mess. You know, they're unemployed, they've got family problems, they're drinking too much, they're gambling. And these days, I think, because everybody has a general practitioner, that's where you start. You go there when you're in distress. And sometimes you feel the need to say, well, I've got a headache, or I've got a bellyache, or I've got a backache. But a tremendous proportion of people that are seen by GPs really don't have problems that are best treated with drugs or operations or multiple investigations. Yet I think there's a huge amount of that going on, which in the end, although sometimes it's suggested that doctors are the people doing the medicalizing, actually they're victims of it as well, because they well recognize that they can't really solve these problems. So in desperation, they do things like prescribe antidepressants. And I mean, antidepressant prescriptions are now at 70 million a year in Britain, having almost doubled in the last 10 years. I mean, something is badly wrong there. So I think we have a terrible tendency to turn life's problems, whether it's suffering, pain, death, misery, whatever, into a medical problem, which is often not very effective for anybody.
I'd agree. And I think what we're seeing is that we're looking at complex problems like death and dying through a very, very narrow lens of healthcare. And I think that's being applied to many different areas, as Richard was mentioning around birth, but also kind of around health and well-being, aging, you know, raising children, all of those issues. Healthcare is too narrow a lens to see that through. And although we've seen tremendous successes in public health, clinical care, medical care, scientific advances over the past few generations, so, you know, treatments for heart attacks, etc., people are living longer as a result, and life expectancy is increasing, you know, that's a great success. But what we're seeing is that lens being applied to death and dying, and people feeling that death is infinitely deferrable. And there's always one more course of treatment that people can give, whether it's appropriate or whether it will actually lead to an enhance in your quality of life or a length of your life is questionable. But there is the belief that that is always there. And I think people, it's easier to not have that conversation because these are very difficult issues to deal with. People find, you know, the idea of loss, of losing people you care for, of suffering, those are issues that people don't want to deal with. And so it's easier to have one more course of chemotherapy or have a further course of antibiotics. But then people are robbed of that chance to know what's happening to them. And I think in my experience of caring for people who are dying, people often have that sense that something is changing. Something's changing physically, something's changing existentially. They are aware that their life may be coming to a close. But it's very difficult to state that if you don't have the language for that, if you feel that somehow you're making a mistake because those people around you aren't making the space for those conversations. And that in itself is deeply distressing and can be a cause of suffering, quite aside from the kind of increased physical treatment and changing locations, admissions into emergency departments overnight, etc. It's the flip side of the success of what healthcare has done. And, you know, we're not to say that we to undermine that. That's been huge. And life expectancy speaks that. But life is not infinite, as we're almost being kind of beguiled into believing. And people want one more course of treatment because they feel that will give them longer life. And I think we're not being honest. And people are not intentionally misleading often. You can have one more course, but the question is, what will it lead to? What will that course of treatment lead to? And I think that's hard on both sides. I think doctors and other people in healthcare are given a hard time for not having that difficult conversation. But often I find people don't want to hear it either. You know, it's on both sides. People are dancing this dance. So you leave the clinic with one more course, but actually a much bigger challenge to deal with than often by yourself.
And one area that it's easy to over-medicalise is grief. I mean, grief is painful and grief can be prolonged and all sorts of strange things can happen during grief. But actually, you know, grief is very much part of life. It's normal. We're all going to experience it. And there is a tendency, if it's not resisted, to medicalise it, to start prescribing drugs, to sending people to professionals. And most of the time, that just isn't needed. People do the best by talking to friends, family, others. You just don't need to turn it into a pathological problem. Sometimes it is, but mostly it isn't. And I think when it is turned into a pathological problem, it actually can prolong the whole business and cause far more suffering than is relieved.
And there's a sense that you kind of get over grief as well, that it's kind of done. You do your grieving and you package it away. Whereas actually many of the kind of newer reflections on grief are that actually you never get over grief. That person is lost forever and that's part of your life. And so actually the work of the bereaved or the grievers is to come to terms with the fact that that person has gone and to incorporate them into your life. And so you don't get over grief. You can't cure grief. And that's one of the other issues, that the medicalization or the pathologizing of grief, it's something to be sorted out with antidepressants, with counseling, with referral into services. Whereas actually, it's a very core part of being human to manage loss. There was an interesting study in Australia by Sama Awan, who asked bereaved people, what helped you? What actually helped you when you were bereaved? And they said, actually, it was unexpected people like funeral directors who were supporting them with conversations about the realities of how to support this themselves, and friends and neighbours who they could talk with on about anniversaries of dying in the future. And these kind of sustainable supports that you have forever, because grief is something that you have forever in different forms, whereas episodic kind of telephone calls from professionals were actually felt to be more unhelpful because they weren't long term. They didn't ask people the real things and they weren't actually supportive. So I think the medicalization extends, you know, from birth right through to grief, really. We see its impact across all of society.
And of course, grief can be very creative. A lot of the best poetry has been written around grieving. I think of Tennyson's In Memoriam. And I think, Libby, I mean, grief has been very important to you in your career and development.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my father died of pancreatic cancer when I was 10, which is obviously a huge event to have in your childhood. And we cared for him at home, but it inevitably, without any doubt, changed my career choice. I was always thinking about doing medicine, but the idea of coming into palliative care, it allowed me to understand kind of what loss means at an early age, but also of what good support and what good care looks like, and how you support people beyond just the individuals and beyond just families, how you support communities and what strength you draw from that. And it made me realize, in a very personal sense, when that's missing. And also just it made me realize I could see people as I was younger, they kind of shrank away from it. It was too big, my grief. They didn't know how to speak to a child about it, and it was so enormous. And I saw them shrinking away from me. And actually all I wanted to do was talk about it. I didn't want to go to counselling. I just wanted to talk about it. And I could see people look at me with such pity, and it was very hard. And I think what grief has given me, as it gives, I think, many people who go through it, everyone's different, but many people get, I now have this sense that actually it doesn't frighten me touching that loss. I think when you've been there and experienced that on such a profound level, it means when I see my patients and people at home who I go and care for in the community, I can open that space for them. And I think that is what people are often trying to build barriers around, because it hurts. It does hurt. That's the thing. There's no way around that. But that's part of being human. And actually, part of the issue is that we're building these fortresses to protect ourselves, when actually we need to be opening them up, exposing that vulnerability. And I think, to come back to that opening question around what humanity or humanizing medicine means. For me, it is about relationships, but you can't have a one-way relationship. You can't be a doctor going in a role with your armor on to then talk about person-centered healthcare to the person in front of you. It has to be a person-to-person interaction. But the problem with kind of metaphorically leaving that armor at the door is that it can be painful. And it's not to say, you know, you go to see a GP and you hear their life story. That's not appropriate. But it's about meeting someone as on a human level and seeing your commonness, you know, your commonality between you. So you can both understand we're people facing this. But the problem is if you see someone in healthcare, and particularly say in palliative care, and you acknowledge your commonality, you also have to acknowledge your shared mortality and your shared risk of being, of losing people you love. And that again is hard. So I can see why people don't wish to do that on a daily basis. But I would counter that and say, we are in a crisis in healthcare, and we talk a lot about the crisis of compassion. And I think COVID-19 has, like many things, brought this to the fore. And we don't really have any other alternative but to engage in healthcare as humans, within our roles as people, in the same way we wish to engage with the people who are ill and who are needing support as people. And we have to both open those barriers, because rather than, I think, leading to resilience and burnout, that kind of entering an interaction as a human being allows you to build much more meaningful relationships, which leads to better healthcare, which leads to better outcomes, which I think, and I would argue, leads to less burnout, less issues with resilience, and less difficulties within healthcare. But it takes a leap, I'd say, and it's not easy.
You know, many of the sort of usual paradigms of healthcare have been basically thrown in the air, haven't they, with COVID. It's changed everything. Things that were absolute sacred cows we were not going to be able to change have suddenly changed. You know, online appointments were not possible, absolutely not possible. And suddenly we're all over online appointments. Has COVID changed this conversation about humanizing death and dying? Has anything changed?
Death is in the air in a way that it isn't normally. And I think we see these stories of people dying alone in intensive care. And I think most people think, my goodness, I hope that doesn't happen to me or any of my relatives. So I think in that sense, death is much more present in our lives at the moment than it normally is. But I'm not sure that it has led to the kind of conversation we need to have about how do we change our relationship with death. I mean, we have death cafes, death festivals, that there are these discussions around death, and there are movements like Dying Matters, which is trying to encourage us to recognize death and think about it more, plan for our funerals, plan for all the sorts of things that will inevitably happen to us. But I'm not, doesn't feel to me, maybe Libby feels differently, or maybe you feel differently, Bev, that it hasn't really initiated the conversation we really need to have. And I hope that was one of the things we hope about our Lancet Commission on the Value of Death, that it will be a platform for launching really the kind of conversation we have to have as a society. And I suppose one thing I do see at the moment, as we begin to think, well, we can't go on lockdown forever, we can't vaccinate everybody, you know, within the next few months. So you see this debate about, well, maybe we need to open up more, recognizing that that might mean more deaths. And is that acceptable or is that not acceptable? I mean, the reality is we do accept deaths every year from flu. And in some years that can be 10,000 deaths, but mostly that kind of goes unnoticed by most of us. So I suppose perhaps it's preparing the ground for a better conversation, but it doesn't feel to me like it's happened yet.
I think it has brought a certain mainstreaming of death, which sounds slightly ridiculous since death is something that, you know, will affect us all at some point. But I think death is often seen, you know, as other, you know, as not affecting us. And there's a huge amount has been discussed around whether we have a death taboo, are we a death denying society? These are the kind of terms that are often discussed. And I think before COVID, we weren't a death denying society. Death was sensationalized. It was everywhere. It was on the front page. I mean, it's on the news headlines of everywhere. It's often the core parts of many films, novels, you know, series. It is everywhere. But what I think I didn't see are the stories of everyday dying, of dying, you know, from heart failure or from cancer at home with a bed in your living room, with a commode and your family caring with nurses coming in. That's not the face of anything. And so people couldn't see that. So they weren't seeing normal dying. So what I think for me has mainstreamed those ideas of kind of everyday dying, dying at home. It's on the front page, it's on the newspapers, it's in everyone's living rooms. But it hasn't brought us any better understanding of it. People still are terrified, understandably, of this. But I think COVID in hospital, it's brought a subtle shifting, I'd say, of power. So, you know, the idea of technology being brought in. You know, you can now have family meetings. Family members from all over the world can now come in on a video call and be present at a ward round, be present at a family meeting. And that's a subtle shift in power, because before, if you weren't turning up at the right time, if you weren't in the right country, you couldn't be attending, you couldn't be part of that discussion. The technology has brought that shift rather than COVID. But I think there's been a real recognition, which has been really important, of the central role of families, communities, networks in dying, and this kind of really frightening exemplification of what dying alone is, where you can't even see the face or touch the hand of the person who's caring for you, the professional, because of the PPE. And I think that is really frightening. And so I think it's really shifted a subtle narrative, which is saying for a long time, families, communities, role, you know, they need to be involved in end of life care. But now we've seen the kind of the ultimate medicalization of that. And I think it's making people really realize that actually families, communities need to be involved along the way and through bereavement. You know, we have people who are then unable to meet family members because of social isolation and physical distancing, and, you know, limits on funerals. I think the reality and the limitations of what a healthcare service can deliver, it can't give that support. You know, it just cannot do that. It couldn't do that with normal numbers of deaths, and it certainly can't do that with the numbers we're seeing with COVID. So I think it's kind of mainstreamed our narrative on death and dying. Whether we're any further along in supporting it, I don't know, but it's now just being discussed. And I think that recognition of the role of families, communities, neighbours is now understood. And the question is where we go next with this, because we're going to have a huge number of people who are bereaved, who have had a very, very difficult year, hugely isolated. And the question is, I think that's one of the urgent questions as we begin to look towards the end of this lockdown, is how do we support people who are deeply isolated and have had significant bereavements this year?
Most people go into healthcare with the best of intentions, don't they? They want to do the best for the patients, and it's the patients that keep them going. What do you think gets in the way of those good people wanting to do the best for patients? And then, yet on the other end of the spectrum, you hear from what Richard was saying, a lot of people having a really, really difficult time at the end of life. What gets in the way?
I suppose my answer would be, you know, it's the system to some extent. And I, you know, when you're sort of stuck there as a junior doctor or even as a consultant, it can be very difficult to change the circumstances and the culture. I think back to when I was a junior doctor in those days, which is a long time ago, it was quite normal, which always strikes me as extraordinary that it was normal, that we would tell relatives that a patient was dying, but we wouldn't tell the patient him or herself, which I think created the most enormous difficulties for people, because often the patient knew but didn't know whether the relatives knew. The relatives knew but didn't know whether the patient knew. And far from strengthening the relationship, which, as Libby says, is so important and central, it threatened it. And now my daughter is a first-year doctor and dealing with a lot of deaths, and I must say, I hear horrible stories from her of sort of treatment going on far beyond the point when it should go on, which is distressing often for the patients, their families, and for the staff. It's very difficult to say, I just don't want to do it like this. I mean, I didn't have the courage all those years ago to say, well, I think we should tell the patient and I think I should be the person to do it. I just didn't have the courage to do that.
I would agree that I think the system is often what wears people down. People don't come into healthcare thinking, I'm going to deliver a really pared back, you know, kind of brutal kind of, you know, consultations with patients. That's not what people want to do. But I think you're asked to deliver things that you often can't deliver, things that are out of your control. So the kind of the KPIs or the kind of outcomes that people want you to deliver often don't reflect either good care, they don't reflect the outcomes that people with the conditions feel are valuable. So you're there delivering on things that you don't believe in. I think one of the reasons I chose to go into palliative care was that you could create, there's a kind of freedom within it because it's deeply person-centered and deeply family-centered. And so one of the benefits of that is that you have a relative freedom to build, to deliver on what that person wants. And I like the idea of not delivering kind of formulaic kind of pathway delivered care, because you could, if you do it well, you're focusing on that person, that family. And that freedom, I think, gives me a kind of an energy, and you feel like you're negotiating around the system. Whereas I think if you feel you are a person, you're just a part of the system without any power, delivering care that you don't feel is the best care that you could be delivering, and trying to meet objectives and outcomes that you don't feel are the best for you, then I think that's hugely demoralizing. And I think that's at the core of a lot of poor care, that people feel they're powerless to fight to change the system. Often the people who've designed the system would love it changed too. You know, it's not that we've got kind of villains and heroes in this, but often it's so big that you cannot begin to dismantle it.
Is anyone getting it right? Have you got other sort of golden nuggets of good practice that we can learn from?
I think what we need is a sort of rebalancing of care at the end of life. So at the moment, it does tend to be doctor medically dominated. I think we need, as Libby's been saying, to involve much more families, communities, networks. And I think crucially, they should be in charge. They shouldn't be the supplicants as they are at the moment. So it's flipping the power. I mean, of course, we're going to need health professionals. They have an important role, but they should be supporting the system rather than running it. Secondly, I think somehow we've got to find a way for health professionals to have the conversations with people who are coming to the end of their life, people who have life-threatening illnesses. Lots of people have spoken about this. The College of Physicians has put out a report, but it seems that it is very difficult for people. And I think in many ways, general practitioners are the best people to have these conversations. And certainly in Scotland, there's a system of anticipatory care whereby the minute somebody, you know, is diagnosed as having heart failure or cancer, something that may well kill them eventually, even if it's going to take a long time, that discussion is initiated. And then thirdly, this one sounds perhaps a little bit weird, but our report is called Commission on the Value of Death. And death does have great value. I think there is a bit of a tendency to think it's just a horrible no-no. It's something we should do everything we possibly can to avoid. So I start by saying, death is part of life. And I think a lot of philosophers would say that the more your consciousness of death, the more you appreciate life. And in Bhutan, you're urged to think of death 5 times a day. And I must say, I think of death regularly. Secondly, I mean, the phrase I always use, without death, every birth would be a tragedy. I mean, death is central to life moving on and progress. And then I think as Libby and other people, palliative care physicians have described, but also family people, Gandhi described this, that caring for people who are dying can be a very challenging but also enriching experience. And then lastly, I'd say, you know, the fact that we all die is something we have in common. I mean, some philosophers say that the fact that we die is actually the most important thing about us.
Thanks, Richard. Libby, what would you add to the list of what should be done?
Well, I'd say we need to understand that death and dying are part of life. They are an inescapable part of life. And through the commission, what we've tried to bring out and highlight is that death and dying take part in systems, as do all aspects of our life. You know, they're interconnected. We are social interconnected beings, and everything that we do and undertake takes part in these enlarged systems. And what we've kind of done is kind of siphoned off death and dying, saying it doesn't take part in that kind of social system. It takes part in a healthcare institution. And so what we're kind of calling for is to again recognize the social determinants of death and dying, as it were, like we are understanding and, you know, absolutely accepting the social determinants of health, of well-being. They're multifactorial, they're connected throughout all of our lives, and they don't end in a kind of sterile room with a certain number of healthcare professionals for the last few weeks of your life. They run throughout our lives. And what we see around the world are some green shoots, some examples of where this model has been understood, has come into practice. And one of them is in the southern state of India and Kerala, where they were kind of forced, I think, to recognize the inadequacy of the medical healthcare model at the end of life for many, many reasons. But we see there huge amounts of out-of-pocket expenditure, where families and communities bankrupt, paying for palliative chemotherapy, etc., that has no reasonable chance of cure. And people often dying with extreme pain and other symptoms unmanaged because opioids were not available for that. And so what they came to was turning the kind of healthcare medical model on its head and saying, rather than life-limiting and long-term conditions, chronic conditions, being medical components with a small social component often that you'd have a social worker referral into, they turned it on its head and they called it a first paradigm shift there to say, actually, these are social problems with medical components. So by flipping that, you say these are problems that are experienced within people's lives, in the place they live, affecting many people who they interact with. They have medical components. You need a medication, you need to monitor side effects, you might need to check up periodically in a clinic. But actually, the majority of people's times are living in their community experiencing this, and medicine needs to flip its understanding of that. So as a result, they went out to the community and said, people who are dying, people who are bedridden, people who are chronically unwell, how are people being cared for? Is this something that you feel is right, or do you want to be involved in changing that? And there was an overwhelming answer from the community in this. Now, obviously, people from Kerala are known as it's a really kind of civically active state, so there was a huge movement already. But people came forward, and that was in the kind of early 2000s, and now there's a network of over 12,000 volunteers who run throughout the state, who support people at the end of life. There's National Palliative Care Days, there's rallies, advocacy, championing the rights of people who are at the end of life, the changed narcotic laws so that there's availability of opioids to everyone who needs it. And they work in partnership with doctors, nurses, other primary healthcare centres. So they're not seen as separate. It's just this is a way that you sustainably manage and support people at the end of life. They also tackled a lot of the upstream of ideas around kind of smoking being a cause of cancer, or the kind of some of the myths around cancer being contagious. So they kind of tackled that out in communities and villages, having these conversations. And because they were members of the same community, these healthcare messages got taken in, and it really spread. So the police, students, schools, bus drivers, everyone was involved in this model. It was really this idea that end of life care and death and dying are everyone's responsibility. So they've really led a revolution in how end of life care and how death and dying are managed and held by society, with input from high quality medical nursing skilled care. It's not saying either or, it just has to go hand in hand.
It sounds like there's a huge amount that we could learn, not just in death and dying, but from that sort of community ownership of health, really, isn't it? It sort of goes hand in hand with the sort of thinking around public health messages and the fact that health lies within communities.
Yeah. And there's good examples of that message being spread from Kerala throughout to Bangladesh, Thailand, and East London. So there's models of it's the compassionate communities model is really how it's being termed to understand how a public health approach to death and dying and grief and loss has a place in every society. And so there are messages, I think, for all of us, as you say, in how we live our lives.
Thank you. Thanks, Libby and Richard. I'm aware that we're running out of time, and I'm so grateful to you both for talking to me today and to sharing the insights. And it sounds that the Lancet Commission is going to be really important in provoking a really important debate that we need to be having as a society.
If you want to find out more about the Point of Care Foundation and our mission to humanise healthcare, you can visit us at pointofcarefoundation.org.uk or at Point of Care Foundation on Twitter.
I hope you enjoyed listening to the Point of Care Foundation podcast today. And if you liked what you heard, please join us again next time when we'll be talking about humanising healthcare during COVID. So thank you very much, and goodbye.